Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. My next guest, according to many people, was supposed to be the next president of the United States, but he decided not to run. He is Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels, and we have a chance to speak with him today as he makes the rounds for his new book, Keeping the Republic, Saving America by Trusting Americans. The book is making some news because he uses the same phrase to describe Social Security as Texas Governor Rick Perry did in his book, and that language is, of course, a Ponzi scheme. But he also says the Perry-Romney debate over Social Security right now is not advancing our understanding, and Daniels would be interested in some possible new candidate who would just be clear about the math of it all. But, of course, there is a lot more than that to talk about. Daniels is a governor who has closed a big state budget deficit, went after public employee collective bargaining rights before Scott Walker, has been cited as a model by Chris Christie, and capped property taxes in his state at 1-3%. Now, that's not a 1-3% annual increase like the new caps in New York and New Jersey. That's 1-3% total property tax. That's a cap. He's also been chief of staff for Senator Richard Lugar, chief political advisor to President Ronald Reagan, and budget director for President George W. Bush. He certainly got the resume to be president. He hasn't ruled out becoming the Veep. Again, the book is called Keeping the Republic, Saving America by Trusting Americans. Governor, thanks so much for coming on WNYC. Hello from New York.
You're great to have us on. Thanks, Brian.
Do you really have a 1-3% property tax cap in your state, hard cap?
We do. 1%, if you're a homeowner, 1% is the maximum you'll ever pay, and it's now constitutional, so it's not subject to the state reneging later. These are the lowest we discover now, the lowest property taxes in America. It's 2% on your farm or rental property, 3% maximum for business property, and we found that important to do for various reasons, to promote and protect home ownership, but also to attract new business, which we believe we can already see it doing.
As I'm sure you know, the new Cuomo and Christie caps in New York and New Jersey are considered fairly aggressive because they cap the growth of the tax by 2% a year, and that's considered a big deal and a big threat by public school systems, which have more inflation than that and rely on property taxes as their main funding mechanism. Are public schools in Indiana also funded mostly through property taxes?
They're funded mostly by state taxes. Indiana devotes a higher percentage of its state budget, 56%, to K-12 education than any state in America. And as elsewhere in America, whatever the problems are in the public schools, it's not inadequate funding. And we have increased that funding and plan to continue doing that as dollars permit. But property taxes, especially after the reform we effected, this was part of it, are now very secondary. They're used for capital and a few other purposes locally. You know, Brian, the thing that has always struck me as so perverse about property taxation is the only place in life where one can adjust the revenue, the income level, to match the spending. Everywhere else, in your family, in your business, at your radio station, and state government for that matter, you decide how much money you're likely to have and try to adjust spending to that. But in property taxation, it's a pretty sweet deal if you're on the spending end, because you decide what you'd like to spend, just dial up the rate unless somebody prevents that.
Right. Do you think Indiana has a good model for the nation with respect to funding education? Because I think even a lot of liberal or progressive policy wonks would say it would be better to even out the inequities from school district to school district, to rely less on property taxes and more on statewide taxes that could then be distributed more equally than rich neighborhoods with a lot of property tax revenue being able to fund their public schools so much more than poor neighborhoods with low property tax revenues.
I'm always bashful about promoting any of the changes that we've made to other states. It's best for each state to decide its own interests. But I will say that on the equities, it's a certainly more straightforward way, I think a much more effective way to accomplish what you talked about. In the previous era, when property taxes were a much bigger share, We had a very clunky and often, I think, inaccurate mechanism for trying to redistribute money around. Now it's a lot easier. We have a formula which, of course, provides more funds to those districts that are trying to teach at-risk kids or disadvantaged populations.
Governor Mitch Daniels of Indiana, my guest on WNYC. His new book is called Keeping the Republic, Saving America by Trusting Americans. Let me jump to what's in the news. You and Rick Perry both call Social Security a Ponzi scheme in your books. Does that mean you got the same talking point memo from somebody?
No, it means we're pretty darn unoriginal. You know, after Governor Perry got attacked for what he said, some people, you may have noticed this, a number of people repaired to the Internet and discovered that this exact analogy has been used over and over and over again for most of the life of Social Security.
In fact, I looked at the Social Security Administration's own website, and they have a description, their own defense, posted in 2009 of why Social Security is not a Ponzi scheme.
Well, one reason it's not really a Ponzi scheme is it's mandatory. You're not forced to take part in a Ponzi scheme, but of course, at Social Security, you are. My actual comment, which I think was not transcribed quite accurately, was that if there's a problem with what Governor Perry said, it's not that it's not true; it's that it's trite. It was amusing really to read Paul Samuelson, whose textbook some of us studied 40 years ago, hardly a right winger. Was one of the first people found, but that very same comparison has been used over and over again by people on both sides of the political street. The only thing I would say, as I defend the general proposition that this is not a matter of opinion, it's a matter of fact that this is a pay-as-you-go system, which hasn't always been represented that way. I would like to see anyone who talks about it take two steps further, Brian. One is to be very, very clear that no one should be talking about changing the system for those currently reliant on it or those soon to be.
And Perry did that in the last debate.
I think he did. Yeah, I have to confess I don't watch these things, but as I understand it, he did. Make it clear that we need to be reassuring to people. We need to say to those who are now or planning to be soon in these systems, both Social Security and Medicare, listen, a deal's a deal. Nothing will change for you. Nothing will change for you. Please rest assured. But now, will you help us try to craft new modified systems for the generations who are paying for your retirement, and so that they can have some peace of mind and some backstop too. I believe that you can speak this way to Americans and move on into the other step, which is to talk about alternatives, and there are many of them, for how we could do that.
If that means privatizing or letting younger workers take part of their payroll taxes for private accounts, like President Bush had proposed, that would create at least one problem, I think, which is even less going into the actual Social Security pot to support the baby boomers who you just made a promise to. It increases the Social Security deficit once it actually comes around 2036. What would you do about that?
Well, in my book, I don't call for that. I have a slightly different slant on things. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the absolutely essential thing we must do is scale down the completely unfundable promises of today. We're going to have to first lower the amount of outflow from the funds in the future. And I'm open to any idea that makes the arithmetic work, but I go ahead and try to be responsible enough to lay out ideas of my own. I'm in favor of means testing these programs. There's never been a reason to send Social Security checks to the wealthiest Americans, except the very cynical, openly political reason that people thought if you didn't have everybody in it, it wouldn't have political support. And I think that sells Americans, the most generous people on earth, very short themselves. So I would means test it. We began over-indexing for inflation midway along. It wasn't the way the system was set up. People ought to be protected against inflation, but not overcompensated, or at least not all of them. And then finally, the retirement age is grotesquely out of date with our demographic realities. And
what do you do about construction workers and people like that who, you know, their bodies are going to wear out by the time they're 65, even if you and I might be able to retire at 70?
Brian, the world we're in, let alone the one we're discussing now, 10 and 20 and 30 years from now, will be so completely different. I don't know, you know, people will have multiple careers. People better be prepared for careers other than construction or heavy labor, which are already, as you know, such a small percentage of the jobs we have even today. I don't think that's a stopper. If so, it can be dealt with specifically. But we, you know, when Bismarck picked the arbitrary age of 65, the average German died in his 50s. When Roosevelt picked it, the average American died at 62. And it was never contemplated that these systems would pay everybody, no matter how wealthy, and that they would pay them for, you know, in this case, 20, 30 or more years. So now, I mean, again, if you do those things, you'll have a system that a 2.0 system for the next generations that will provide them that safety net we, I think, all support. But, you know, if somebody's got a better combination of ideas, I'd like to hear it. I just want to see some action.
Governor Mitch Daniels, Republican from Indiana, new book, Keeping the Republic, Saving America by Trusting Americans. You were President Bush's budget director.
Yep.
First couple of years.
Yep.
And obviously everybody's talking about the deficits right now and the accumulated debt, $14 trillion, and what to do about it. Democrats complain that Bush caused much of this debt problem by putting the Iraq and Afghanistan wars off the books. That's roughly $1 trillion in borrowing, while cutting taxes on the wealthy by about the same amount. Do they have a point?
No, they really don't. I mean, it's not necessary to defend any of those decisions, to just simply look at the factual math and see that they are a very, very small part of the problem we've come into. This is a horse, the deadest horse in the corral, but people keep trying to ride it. I mean, we're putting on twice as much debt in the first 5 years of this administration as in we're doubling the debt in 5 years, tripling it in 10. There's more deficits in any 2 years, including the prospective proposals of this administration, than the Bush administration piled up in 8. The famous tax cuts, if you cancel them all, you solve a single-digit percentage of the problem that we have going forward. So, you know, I don't spend any time really in the book. I try to avoid looking backwards or casting blame at anybody for the bubble, for instance, that's really the biggest cause of our current situation. I think in the situation as urgent as the one we face, blaming, looking around to apportion blame is a waste of precious time. I really do.
Just look
forward. Question
is,
what do we do now?
We're just about out of time. Are you going to endorse in the Republican primaries?
Oh, I might. I mean, I don't know who'd care who what I said if I did, but you know, I might well. I expect I will support the nominee of our party because I really do believe that we need a change in national direction, in the direction of solvency, in the direction of growth of the private economy. But you know, right now I'm simply trying to promote ideas and maybe a little different way to approach Americans. I will say this. I hope that the Republican nominee will do a couple of things that I think would be important to us all. One is to speak the language of unity and to discipline him or herself not to speak so divisively as many sometimes do, as the president did this week. And secondly, to take a chance. I talk about trusting the American people. I really believe we can address the American people about the urgency of our problems and the practical approaches that we need to take and secure their support. I've called this campaigning to govern, not just to win.
Mm-hmm.
And I worry a little bit as the president gets in deeper and deeper trouble that the Republican nominee may just decide to present himself as the default option. And I think that would be a default in itself because time is short here.
Does campaigning to govern rather than to win for a Republican mean not going so hard right?
Well, I don't know if that that's the label to put on it. What I'm really talking about is speaking very openly and specifically about the changes in economic policy, about the changes in fiscal policy, about the safety net we were discussing. And taking the chance, you know, of course, these things will be demagogued and misrepresented, but taking the chance that Americans are smart enough and future-oriented enough to look past those bogus criticisms. And, you know, what you'd like to do is win the next election with a large consensus of Americans ready to make big change. We made a lot of changes in our state of Indiana the last few years, a state that wasn't known for that. And we have found over and over, big change requires big majorities.
I did read on your Wikipedia page that in your first year as governor, you balanced the budget through a combination of spending cuts, privatization, and tax hikes. Maybe President Obama would cite that line from your Wikipedia page. We have 30 seconds left. Is that accurate?
It isn't. There were no tax hikes. It is accurate that I asked for one, a one-time tax on the wealthiest Hoosiers. It was going to be the quickest way I could see to pay off the debts that our predecessors piled up, but it didn't pass, and we got the job done without it.
Why not a good idea for President Obama, then?
Because every decision that that our federal government makes for the next stretch of time, many years, I think, has to be tested against one question. Will this make the growth of the private economy stronger or not? Right. Everything else, however important, needs to take second place to that, and that's in the interest of every single American.
Governor Mitch Daniels of Indiana, his new book, Keeping the Republic, Saving America by Trusting Americans. I hope we can talk again. Thank you very much.
Brian, thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, why frames for eyeglasses cost so much money. One reason is that a single company owns many of the fashion labels and two of the huge eyeglasses chains. We'll go inside the eyeglasses monopoly coming up next. Oh, and you can start calling right now with how you avoid exorbitant prices for eyeglass frames. 212-433-WNYC. We want your tips. 212-433-9692, or post it to WNYC.org. Click on Live on Brian Lehrer Show. That's already a very active eyewear page at this moment. Click on Brian Lehrer Show or call 212-433-9692.